We had a retreat for 4 days or 5 days, and we have questioned for 5 months. So we live to answer in a concise way. And it is true, during those few days we have touched many, many topics actually, not only non-duality. And I know when sometimes making some statement that they will need some clarification, an explanation, but that the time we have, and I think we are trying to explore in the best way possible. So tonight I'll try to answer a few questions, to bring some clarity, but not all. There are some topics that will take a long time. We'll just mention them, and we thought with Patricia, she will read the question and then I will try to answer. So in this sense, we get the question and maybe some answers. So she will read the question, a few questions with the same topic, and then I will try to answer. And then we have divided in a few topics so that something will be answered, but not everything. And it's not in our intention, otherwise Tovana doesn't need to invite us anymore if we answer all the questions. So we want to leave it for another time, so we always keep some kind of answer or pretend that we have some answer for the future. So we'll answer only some aspect of the questions.
Last night you used mind and consciousness alternately. Do you mean they are the same? If not, what is the difference? If consciousness has no locality and is not defined in time, then can remembering or dreaming of another place be considered part of here and now? The remembering occurs now, dot, dot, dot.
So with respect to vocabulary, it's quite tricky. It is true, I've used mind and consciousness in the same sense. And if we read philosophy or psychology, we see that there is no agreement in the meaning of those words. And so we have to choose some meaning, but there it is the same, mind and consciousness. Now with respect, what was the second part?
Remembering.
If there were.
Consciousness has no locality, not defined. Can remembering or dreaming of another place be considered here and now?
Yes, the question of about remembering or thinking about another place, if it can be considered here and now. But you may have noticed we have never used here and now in this retreat, because it's a making of something here and now that maybe is not necessary. So of course, if we think about another time, another place, and then this experience is arising in the consciousness at this very instant. So anything, even if we think about the past, we can even think about things that do not exist, but they're still arising in the consciousness at this time. So it's not a matter of even location or not, it's just that it is arising now, and it's just the awareness arising on this aspect of these memories, for example.
The Buddha uses many words for nibbana, unborn, unconditioned, deathless. Are these all ways of describing non-grasping or the end of suffering?
Yes, I can think that it's a different way of speaking about freedom, about non-grasping, and about unconditioning.
Before I was born, I was unborn, and it didn't really matter to me. Then, so is deathless any different? Why say deathless and not just death? Does deathless mean non-clinging to birth and rebirth?
So to say I was when I was not born is a bit strange, because to state an existence because one is born, before one is born. But to speak about death, it is a negation. Deathless is quite different. Deathless means that we cannot say there's a death, is a negation of the death, and also it's unborn, so there is no, in the unconditioned, there is no birth, neither death, so it's not like death. Death will be a definite statement, a negative statement. So speaking about the unconditioned, we don't want to it to be grasped in any way that what it is the unborn and the deathless.
Can you say a few more words about the absolute? That which is prior or beyond awareness. Is the realization of that something that can be confirmed within or by another? Or does it remain like a feeling of awe, wonder, and mystery? So two questions.
So many traditions state an absolute. There is some absolute that can be God, or that can be the One, or that can be stated in different ways in the Buddhist tradition. Main part of the Buddhist tradition, there is no absolute. There is nothing that one can find as a ground of being, or something that will be the ground out of which everything is arising. Or the absolute cannot be stated in terms of it exists, it does not exist. There is not an absolute that is ground. Every experience, every phenomena cannot say to exist or not to exist. So if we look for an absolute as something, sometimes people speak about cosmic voidness or something like that. That is not really in the Buddhist tradition. So that's not a view. So the absolute in the Buddhist tradition is in the middle between it is and it is not, as the Buddha was mentioning in the sutra.
Is the realization of that something that can be confirmed or stays as a feeling of awe or wonder?
Yes, with respect to the confirmation, which is an interesting question actually, how can we know that our realization is really the end, and that we are not still in some state of confusion? I think from the text it says that there is a certainty that even if all the Buddha were gathered and said it is not the truth, you will not believe them. So it's a strong certainty. And I remember, to take another example, I remember in a conversation written on the meeting of Maurice Blanchot and Georges Bataille, a French writer, and Georges Bataille had mystical experience, spontaneous mystical experience. And when speaking with Blanchot, he said, but how can that be authentified? What gives me the certainty that this experience is the truth? And Blanchot said, the experience is its own authority. That in a sense, it has its own clarity. So we can know that it is for sure. There is a certainty there. Not in the sense of grasping it in this way or that way. But maybe on the contrary, it's such an ungrasping that one could not imagine a further grasping. So there may be an element of certainty in the experience that there is no going beyond, because everything has been ungrasped, if you like, so maybe a certainty. Now, can you imagine we could go and speak to an awakened master and ask if our experience is it? Although there's always a difficulty to express something like that, which is quite subtle, and the difficulty to be understood also. But I think we still have a few little practice to do before. But I hope, no problem if people are this degree of certainty, and I don't doubt that it is a possibility, not a doubt.
So all these questions now are related to thinking, thoughts, and mostly there are quite a number of questions about the meaning that was exposed this morning. Okay, so in the process of writing my question and thinking about it, I've noticed that my awareness to my thinking didn't stop the thoughts because I wanted intentionally to think. So awareness stops the automatic thoughts? Question. The thoughts that pop out from nowhere without choosing or without intention? Can you clarify this? Continue. I would like to try to explore my thoughts, but at the moment I'm aware to a thought, it is gone, and there's nothing to explore. When I explore thinking, being intimate with thinking, not like hearing, where my awareness doesn't stop the sound, and the same with seeing, when I'm with thinking, most of the time the thought disappears. Mm-hmm. You've said this morning to stay with the meaning of thought or thinking. I'm not sure I understand this point.
As I've mentioned this morning, within a thought there is a formulation and there is a meaning. And I said that there are different things because people could hear the formulation in a language they do not understand and they don't understand the meaning. So it's something quite different. Now with respect to the formulation, it's quite short. Buddhist tradition, they have a name for those two aspects. One is the general sound and the second is the general sense. We find that already in the Buddhist commentary quite early. So something of course we can find in modern linguistics also. And here it has some implication in our practice. I don't want to go into linguistics, but in the practice it has some implication because, as people mentioned, if I want to be aware of a thought, it's gone. And the formulation is very short, but the meaning stays in the mind a bit longer. I'll try to explore that. If I give you an apple and I ask, how does it taste? So you will take the apple and bite and chew and then maybe say, oh, that's very sweet. Okay. But if the meaning did not stay after the end of my question, then how would you taste it? Where will the question be? Because when I have said, does it taste good or how does it taste? It's gone. And you don't need to repeat yourself, how does it taste, how does it taste, how does it taste, how does it taste. So it has an impact very clearly afterwards. So if we were only concerned with the formulation, I think thought will have no impact, no power. We'll need to think them again and again and again. So and no question will have a meaning. Because between the question and answer, there's a gap. And you will have forgotten the question when you may wonder about the answer, because formulation is gone. So there's a sound, formulation, as I said, and then there is a meaning. So when one is not making this separation, it is true, the formulation arise, disappear, arise, disappear. And when I am aware of that, when I'm observing thought like that, I'm using observing for this way that I may be doing here now, then I start to have a different relationship to the thought. It's not anymore what I'm thinking that I'm interested in, but in what is this thought. Therefore it loses its power. It's gone. Immediately I think, what it is about is gone. When I'm thinking, I have an intention. If I think about how to go to Tel Aviv, then I have an intention to figure out which road I should take tomorrow. So there is an intention, and that the usefulness of that, what I am concerned with. But when now I am turning my interest into how I am thinking, that what is the nature of those thoughts, so the usefulness disappear. You see, it's like I'm using a tool and suddenly say, what is this tool like? You know, oh, I'm looking at the tool. Oh, that's made this way and that way. Usually when we use a tool, we don't look at the tool. And it's better, because if you use a hammer, you look at the hammer. So that's quite important. So we change completely the situation when we start to consider the thought, even in a general sense. So it loses its interest. Therefore, it stopped, maybe. Then there is no thought anymore, because I'm not anymore into a useful way. How should I go to Tel Aviv tomorrow? This is not anymore my preoccupation. It was, what is this thought? Gone. So that when we are concerned with the formulation, or formulation meaning are linked together, but when we inquire into thought, and it's just one possibility, it doesn't mean the only way and the way that should be made, but I found it so interesting, with very, very simple statements, you know, it is good, it is not good, it's a nice day, or something very simple to be aware of the meaning. So it's a nice day means something. So the formulation, I'm not so much concerned, it has gone, but the meaning does not need to be known by the mind. The meaning is always a knowing of it. There is no separation, and then I can expand the meaning as awareness, because it doesn't need to be known. There is no meaning that I would not know. I have a thought and there is a meaning that I don't know. It's completely absurd. So by being aware of that, one can discover this quality of in the thought being experienced as just awareness. It needs some sensitivity. In my practice, sometimes it's very clear and simple, and sometimes, how can I be so complicated? You know, why I do that? And suddenly, oh yes, that's... But when I have sensitivity, I always find it so powerful. I find it very powerful. And how sometimes one could be bound by a thought, you know. And sometimes very silly thoughts, but one is still bound by them, and when I get this inquiry, suddenly I can see this thought is has no substance nowhere. When I say we give to the thought a concrete reality like that of a stone, it's like my thought exists like a concrete object. But when we get to this intimacy with the thought, we see that they have no location, there is no substance to it, so to speak. And then they lose their power. This doesn't mean anything anymore. It means only something within itself. It's beautiful, just meaning beautiful. Doesn't say anything about the world, because the world is, as it is, neither beautiful nor ugly. This is just a judgment that the mind is bringing. And that brings a lot of space and freedom when we can inquire into that. Now, there was a question about mental images also. It's different here. There's a sound, a general sound, as I say, that expression, if you like, of the thought. Now, an image doesn't need to have words, so to speak. I can meditate, and then an image of a person, image of a place, or of an object, or something like that. And this image also doesn't need to be known by something else. It has its own knowing within it. But when we believe it needs to be known, then we keep a distance, and there is no intimacy with the imagination. But when we can have this intimacy with the imagination, realizing that the image has its own knowing, its own awareness, it's aware of itself, there's no other way for it to be, then it's also losing its power. And I use the example of desire, because sometimes in the practice, desire can be very strong, it can be aversion also. And then when there's an image, suddenly, it's quite amazing, an image arises in our mind, and then we get upset, or we get happy, or excited. All that comes from just the creation of the mind. And this is burning as we may come out of the meditation hall, very, very upset, you know. Nobody has come in this hall, you know, but one is so upset, or I don't know, well, I should really do that, you know, this house, I saw whatever excitement, you know, but no house has been coming in the hall, nobody's coming, but only the meditators. So how we can get disturbed just by the creation, and when we see that, just the imagination, mental image as having their own knowing, their own awareness, because that's what their substance is, so to speak, then they lose their power to bind us. Now, with thinking or imagination, that doesn't mean we will not know how to use them. That suddenly we go to work and say, well, I don't know what to think anymore or to imagine. It's not like that. I mean, we are not going to forget. But at time, it is interesting to inquire more deeply, you know, what is the nature of that. Bring a lot of freedom.
Can we be in the thinking and just the thinking with the same ease as in hearing or seeing? How? How can we see thought in our practice, in seeing, hearing? It's easier. How can we see thinking, just thinking? Priez pour le moi, tu veux? Le je. How the illusion of time and space is created in the mind. How and why the sense of spokesman, the I, is born in consciousness. If consciousness is not aware of any object, how does the sense of an I is born in consciousness as I, which is just an object?
So it's a quite vast topic about the...
I'm going to say this one too.
With respect to the non-dual notion of seeing and just seeing, still if I close my eyes, the seeing will be gone. If I do not touch, there will be no touching sensation. If I die, all experience will stop. No? Question mark. Maybe you can say a bit more about the place or role of I in this process of experiencing.
So the notion of I is quite an important one and also a subtle one, not only in the Buddhist tradition, but in any tradition. So I cannot address all the issue here, but... But the point is that I think it is important to realize that the notion of I is essential in our own formation. It would be absurd to believe that we could educate a baby without the sense of I, and that would be dramatic. It would be the worst thing we could ever do. So this notion of I is necessary in order to become a conscious being. So that's a construct that is quite important. Although we question it and we see how burdensome it can be, we can also see its importance in the way of the becoming conscious. So I don't want to go too much in detail with that. Now, if we imagine how that can be construct, right? I think there is some simple element. First, imagine the hours that the mother and father spend just looking at this baby with the notion of there's a being there, you know, there's a specific being there and calling by name and things like that. So it's very convincing. And it is important and it is essential. We know that is not when that is not being done by the mother or father, then there is a very, very strong image in the child. So that is very important that the child get this sense of identity and separateness. And through this sense of identity and separateness, it is possible to be conscious. Otherwise, there will be And there is, I think, when this development is not done properly, then there's a much less clear sense of consciousness and awareness. So the culture and the parents and the psychology help us to create this sense of self, and that is very important. That's why to try to be smart and not to transmit that to a child will be really dramatic. So that's quite important. Now in the practice, what we will see that it is a construct, and that it has its sense, but it does not, there's no entity, no special entity or substance that is here that can stand for the I. So we can use it, and we should use it, but not anymore believe that there's a strong entity there that is standing for the sense of I. So that what the exploration in the meditation will do, we'll still say I, not going to start to speak in a strange way, trying to avoid to say I, you know, which doesn't help so much, just bring more confusion. So in one sutra it is, somebody asked, Buddha said, well, it must be a later sutra, but it said, well, if there is no I, why do in every sutra you start, thus have I heard, you know? So there is no I, and why in every sutra you say, thus I have heard? And the Buddha says there's three sources for the sense of I. One is confusion, one is pride, and one is convention. And the two first one have to be get rid of, and the third one has to be cultivated. So the sense of communication that need to be kept. So not starting to try not to use a sense of I. So in the, I think it is easier, it's true, to understand in hearing just hearing and seeing just seeing. When I say that, it doesn't mean that it is always easy. I don't want to make people feel, well, I don't understand what it is about. I should be, I think I'm very dumb, you know, I don't understand. And I hated when I had teachers saying, you know, it's very simple, and I could not really get what they were saying, and I really felt quite bad. You know, why do I not understand that which is so simple? So I would not like to give this sense, but through the practice, I think it's not so difficult to start to open to this dimension of hearing, just hearing, seeing, just seeing. And as I have mentioned, I think, yesterday, in order to do that, we have to let go of the concept that is built around what we are hearing. If I think I'm hearing the bird, then I cannot be hearing just hearing, because the bird is not in my consciousness. It's a concept here that I'm holding on, but the sense of this bird is an outer object and brings some confusion. It is only in the sensitivity, when I'm just listening very carefully, what is this sound like, just being so close to hearing, then at this time there's just hearing. And not because I've tried to get rid of the concept or the concept of I, but I've just been concerned with this expense of hearing. It's the same with seeing, just being concerned with the expense of seeing. As I mentioned, the possibility of looking in various directions, so that it's very clear that we are constructing what the object that we are seeing, but the experience is quite different, so just to rest in the experience. Now with thinking it can be exactly the same, but it is true, it is maybe more confusing, and that's what I've been explaining. That can happen only, I think, if we rest in the, or that can happen more easily if we rest in the meaning. So in the thought on thinking, just thinking, I would say in the meaning his knowing of the meaning is the same, in the meaning just a meaning, and it doesn't need to be known by something else. So at this time, in thinking, just thinking can really be experienced with the same sense of non-separation. And at this time there is no sense of I think, there is just thinking.
I really appreciate being here with you, no doubt about it, but I don't understand how non-duality reality is for you such an intellectual, elaborated approach? How non-duality experience may occur with words and understanding and so many concepts. For me, non-duality is an experience which, when it occurs, how there are no words to testify about it, just openness, boundless, and smile. So my question is, how to be in non-duality here and now? How to experience it? How to be with it in a very fragmented world later? How to stabilize it? So that.
So, there's nothing we can do to experience non-duality. And as it was clear right from the beginning, there's nothing that we can do. And often the tendency is, yes, but what should I do? Nothing we can do, but we can do very much in order not to experience it. So in this sense, what we're questioning is all the way and the belief we have that make it not possible. That is why in the Buddhist tradition the right view is so important. Because in a sense, if I'm holding to my ordinary vision of the world, this does not fit, does not allow an experience of non-duality. So the right view is there to question the assumption we have about the reality of the world, so that in a sense we can open to something different, something else. So it's not that we will get the conviction of non-duality and start to try to reach and grasp at this conviction, but it is more a sensitivity that we can let go of our belief in what make this experience of non-duality not possible, because we believe and we grasp. So in this sense, so when we speak about the right view, it's in a way to question our belief and to open to this possibility. And I think sometimes people have experience, certainly have experience of non-duality, we're speaking in a vast sense here, and this experience may not be with wisdom, because there is no ground in which it can land that question, the wrong belief in reality. Yeah. I try to give you some example. I think one French writer, Paul Valéry, writes beautifully about experience, very clearly non-dual. But it seems this experience was cut from the rest of his experience in life, because it was just like an experience, a trip that he used in his poetry, certainly, but it was cut. He could not see that was questioning his vision of the world. I'm not analyzing Paul Valéry, which I don't know so well, but it's just sometimes some people have deep experience, and just a trip, you know. That was such a deep experience, and it doesn't seem that it has any impact, it doesn't change, because this experience did not challenge belief, ordinary belief. So in this sense, when we speak about the right view, it also helps suddenly to that the experience of non-unity that may arise, that suddenly it also does lead to a letting go of wrong beliefs. Well, I think that's one important aspect. Now, I have spoken, I think, the first evening maybe, or the first morning, about the attitude for the practice, and that any attempt to get rid of something or to promote something in our experience is a presupposition that has true reality, and that it is in the attitude of not resisting the actuality of what we're experiencing, that there can be an openness that can open to non-dual experience. So this resisting reality by pushing away something or trying to hold on to something. This is, in a sense, that what we need to be aware and not to foster, not to give energy in it, so that we can just be open to the situation. And then it is possible at this time that we don't hold on to duality. So the attitude is, in a sense, very simple. The attitude is an attitude of not resisting, of not wanting something, not to want to get rid of something, not believing that there is something to get, not feeling not to get it. So this is, the attitude is very simple. Now, our mind is more complex, and we may say, yes, I understand, there's nothing I should try to get rid, but if I get rid of sleepiness, that still would be much better, you know. And if I get rid of that, yeah, I understand what he said, but I don't agree. I think sleepiness is really a problem, you know. How can you be sleepy and awake? This doesn't work, you know. And sadness also is kind of difficult, and then anger is a problem. So we start to, and all those, we laugh, but I mean, we can see that in our practice in so many times, you know, in subtle ways. So I think in this sense we are quite similar to each other. So the attitude is very simple, but we are playing it in many ways. We are avoiding that in many ways. So if we ask a tool, then how should I do? What should I do? Now again, we believe there's something to be done. Already when we ask this question, what should I do? We believe there's something to be done. Or we may be aware the first instant of our sitting, you know. We sit and we have already a program. First I quiet my mind, so I start with a few breathing, and then, okay. So we have already a program. And it's so clear, even if we are very aware, yeah, first I get my position, and then could I start like that, you know? And that's fine. Can I be fully like that? Maybe my position will naturally change and get more balance. Can I start to be in a position completely out of balance? Not here, if I am like that, I believe, no, that's not the meditator. The meditator should be like that, you know? So, but what is the truth of like that when I am like that? This truth is just an imagination. So can I be fully like that? And I think it's interesting to explore that when being tired, for example. Could be tired. I can be fully present in this tiredness. It's not that I need, as a meditator, to be like that. We have models of meditators sitting straight, you know, not asleep and something like that, as I said. Sometimes in group of meditators, professional meditators, so waiting to speak, everybody take a professional position. But it is so strange. Why could I not be, I could be, you know, in a position like that and fully present, that's fine. That's fine. Okay. So I think that's quite important to see. There's something to change, how we come to with this attitude. Now there's another remark I will say about intellectual understanding of non-duality. If we look at the people that were the great expounder of non-duality, we see Shankaracharya died at 36 or disappeared. He wrote so many treatises till he was 36. It's amazing the amount of text he wrote. We look at Longshenpa, he died much later, but his collection of texts are huge. We look at Dogen, the great Zen teacher, and his collection of work is very vast. So in a sense, the attitude is very easy to describe. Now, what we have to deal is all the confusion that want to say yes, but. And then we need to speak about the view. Of course, in all the treaties, they did not only speak about that, many elements that were also helping not to grasp at wrong attitude in the practice.
So I gather he answered all the questions in relationship to attitude. They're gone. So, if mind only, what is the world?
Okay. Okay, so I never say mine only, because it's not a vision that for me is a proper vision and not the proper Buddhist vision. I spoke about the consciousness last night as a in in the unfolding of meditation, some things that can happen that suddenly is just awareness and no object, because one loses interest in object, it's not a necessity to go through that, but it's a deep possibility, but not overvaluing this pure awareness or pure consciousness, not giving any ultimate value, is not a need like that. And I think Longchenpa very, very clearly said that some people pretend to teach what I've been exposing, what I've been teaching, and they say only man exists. And he said those people are misleading, those people are wrong. So I don't want to go into the polemic about that, but I don't say man only is not something that I've been speaking about, although I've spoken about pure awareness as an experience that may arise. But this pure awareness also is not more existing than any other object or any other phenomena.
If I is a concept, then when I say I love you, has no meaning. A concept can't love. So how do you see the relationship with your significant one?
Well, it is, of course, this question is the same as, so who is seeing if there is no I, you know? Who is seeing when there is no I? Consciousness is seeing. The nature of consciousness is to be aware, so when the conditions are there, you know, the light and so on, then there is seeing happening. So the seeing is happening is a consciousness seeing. And in the same sense, if there is love, here we have to speak in a love with, which is without attachment, this attitude of kindness and so on, then at this time we can say the consciousness is loving. But if I love you with attachment, then it is grown on the I, and then the concept of I, there is a belief, is solidification, as I explained last night, of consciousness, and we can hold on to that, and therefore I love you, and we hold also to the you. That is the play of confusion, something that we all know very well, but it's on this belief of the I. It is true that if one would be completely free of a sense of I, although it is very frequent to be completely free of the sense of I, but there will certainly not be this attachment in this I love you, this very personal way of I relating to you.
Continue. There's a little more to this aspect. I'm concerned this retreat about how to practice non-duality regarding another person. So if to say another person with a mind of his own. When sound or smell reveals itself, it's a sound or a smell, or a phenomena. But with another person, we have a two-direction relationship. Even the word relationship includes relation. To relate on someone, something, it means a dualism by itself. Can you explain, please?
Mm-hmm.
Could you see the benefit for Western meditators to work in couples and groups during retreats? In order to enhance the awareness of where there is clinging, avoiding, reacting to aversion.
Mm-hmm.
You do that.
So the first question with respect to relationship and another person, and that's certainly a question that will be very strong for people. Think that only man exists, and the existence of the other will be a problem. But here is not what is being said. We said that we cannot say anything that it does exist or it does not exist, but then it has all a relative existence. So in this sense, we are not negating appearance, and that's quite important in this approach of meditation. Is not that we try to get rid, although I've spoken about pure consciousness, it's not a necessity, we don't need to go through that and to see that this pure consciousness does not exist. It can be done in any experience. I mentioned the first day. So in this sense, even seeing another person, seeing an object, all the world of appearance, the way we move in the world, will not change, suddenly does not melt into one something, just exactly the same appearance. Yet the state of existence that we give to it is different, so they will be in the same way, different object, different person that we can speak and so on. The grasping of it will be different. Now, I think in this kind of question, so what will we, how would I deal with other if I will be awakened? I think we'll find the solution when we are awakened. And it's not a way to avoid the question, but not to believe then that we will be in a situation of difficulty suddenly, of not be able to relate to other. If it were the case, of course, then awakening will not be something that will be worth looking for it or exploring. So it doesn't change anything. There is a short Zen story, like Zen story, who can understand them, but anyway. But it does, I think, show the simplicity. One monk come to his teacher and said, well, I just came to the monastery, can you teach me? And the teacher said, did you eat your rice? And he said, yes. He said, now please clean your bowl, your cup. And then the monk was awakened. So, you want me to repeat the story? So, but what is interesting here is that it shows that nothing has been changed. That's not that we should get rid of fool or the monk or the dialogue. It's the simplicity. Nothing has been changed. We don't need, it's just maybe the clinging to the situation is very different. So it doesn't mean that things would appear differently and suddenly there would be a big melting pot of everything, everything will be one or that. Not at all. In this story, it's very clear. Nothing is being changed. Yet, one situation, one is awakened, in the same situation, one can be completely bound. So it doesn't change the appearance of the relationship. It does change the way one is experiencing it or the way one feels in this world, either with grasping or without grasping. But when there is no grasping, doesn't mean that everything disappears. How to be in a relationship in a retreat?
Could you see the benefit for Western leaders to work in couples and groups during retreat in order to enhance the awareness where there's clinging?
So I don't know what it means in a retreat to work in a couple and because the setup is still a setup very clear that first we can all be together in silence surrounding and keep that. It has a very strong value. We can feel that. It is this few days we spend together, we could feel the quietness that allow for a very subtle exploration or opening. So I think it would be difficult to work on why to use the retreat in order to work on one's relationship. I think for me there are other setups which are maybe more skillful than in a retreat, especially if you are not supposed to speak. Then it's, you know, it's so difficult. We've done a lot of retreat with Patricia and sometimes I did experience difficulty because we can't speak. So suddenly you read some gesture, something like that, you know, and you cannot go and say, what do you mean by that? And then you start to imagine. So often it's quite complex, you know. So I would think that there's already so much to explore in one's meditation, sitting peacefully and being with oneself, so to speak. And then it is possible maybe at the end of the retreat start to use some sensitivity, which is in a different context. But I think it's difficult to want to do everything in a retreat. And I think if we explore non-duality as we've been doing that, I think it's quite a challenge. So that it should be enough to keep us busy, although there is nothing to be done, you know. So I think sometimes in retreat we we would like to get so many benefits in many things, you know. So I'll keep healthy, I'll do some jogging, and I will do that and that. I understand that, because I can also see my attitude in that, you know. It's nice, it's quiet, I have time, it's a good thing. And suddenly wanting so many benefits that we forget to really see what is a specific situation. It's very rare to have a situation as in retreat. It's so rare, so difficult to gather people in silence. And oneself to find the place and time, possibility to be in silence. So let's use what is specific to the retreat. And then the jogging we can do. We don't need to be in silence to do jogging. We can hear music and whatever. So let's use what is really specific to the retreat. That's my sense.
The last one. Vipassana practice often sets practitioners on a long drawn-out cycle of looking, deconstruction, hopefully, and repatterning. Longchenpa describes this as bondage and suggests non-meditation and non-practice. Here at the confluence, is there a relationship between these ways? And why practice if the light is inherent in this very moment? Is practice itself our bondage? Is vipassana merely a way to keep busy while now continuously unfolds beyond our control?
Yeah, that is very inspiring. So non-meditation, but did you try that? Non-meditation is the most difficult thing to do. You sit down or even not sitting down, so try to practice non-meditation. So in a sense, This statement do make sense, and Longchenpa said that, this great Tibetan master, but in other places he said other things, he said many other practices in his volume. So I think I would like to speak a few words in a sense, so we understand a little bit how do the various aspects of the practice fit. There's something quite striking. It seems that some people have experience and they never leave this experience. If we think about Ramana Maharshi at 16, lying down in his kitchen, believing he was dying, and then when he stood up, he was awakened, and it seemed that he never got back into confusion. There are a few stories like that, and we wonder why some other, you know, or I got into some experience, and then I got just a minute later, I was in deep confusion. So what is the difference? What does make for this difference? I also would rather just have an experience, very clear awakening, and then never ever again to explore, you know, that. So what does make the difference? Why? And it doesn't seem that there was a very much practice in Ramana Maharshi. You know, he was very young, and I don't think he had received such a deep teaching. So if we explore that, and I think that's quite an important question. So what does make it possible, or why sometimes I would sit down and it seems it's easy to meditate, and at other times it's nearly impossible. You know? What does make this possibility? And I remember once my old teacher, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, said that there's no way one would realize the nature of mind or reality. Not a problem, but it depends on the quality of our inner energy. So in a sense, we see that ignorance, especially in the tantric tradition, which I think is very rich in this sense, ignorance is not only a wrong way of thinking, it's also an unbalanced way of being emotionally. And if we are in this wrong way of being emotionally, then we may try not to do anything. We get it. It's not difficult to understand that. Vocabulary is not so complex. So we sit down and we have this intention. I don't want to do anything. I understand. It seems it can only work this way. And then after a little while, we feel so tense. And then we say, well, but I don't really want to tense. But we start to realize that, or suddenly emotion is arising, or anger, or fear, something is arising, and we don't want to cling to it, but we are caught in that. So I think there is still a disposition of the organism, not speaking only about our way of thinking. I think the problem was just the way of thinking. I think one weekend will be enough, you know, but it doesn't think that one weekend is enough. So there is also a way of being which is emotionally and physically, but there is a holding and energy not flowing clearly in the body. If we see the way that in tantric tradition they describe an experience of awakening and simplify that, and that's fine. It's like the energy also is gathering in the central channel, in the heart center, and there's an experience of awakening. So there's also some kind of physiological dimension to the awakening. And when we see Ramana Maharshi describing, he was dying. And when they describe the experience of dying or deep sleep, it is very similar. All the air energy gather in the central channel. So in this sense, this parallel between an experience of dying and awakening is just because of the energy are not going outward anymore, not in an unbalanced way. So that way in our practice we meet sometimes unbalanced energy, and although we understand very much what the practice is about, even if it is not about doing very much, we still have to face this unbalanced energy. And then that where the practice comes, I mean, the practice that we are doing, that where a vipassana, traditional vipassana, being aware of the tension of the emotion, is very rich and very helpful. Because if we are an organism very fluid, then that will find we would not need anything. I think there is a strong link there. And for me, the vipassana practice that we are doing usually in a more formal way help also to touch those areas of holding and emotion, and to bring mindfulness in that, so that we can also free sometimes those places of holding and emotional bounds. So then there's a disponibility that at this time, then not to do anything will be meaningful, and there's something that is opening. But when we are in a state of holding, there is holding within us, and this holding is always depending on concept. The body only says cramp, but the body does not hold if it has no intention to hold, in a sense. I don't want to go too much into that. So it's mean when there's this tension, those holding, those emotions that are being blocked, there's a lot of concepts that are linked with that. Now say, I would explore being without concept, but we have plenty of concepts there that are holding. And if we don't realize that, we even don't realize that we have concept about those holding. Now we are dreaming about not conceptualizing, not holding to any concept. And we don't meet that, we just meet the difficulty. There's something that it is not so fluid, it's not so simple. And I'm fighting in my practice. I have no intention to do something, but I find that there's no sensitivity in that sense. So we have to meet that. And in the tantric tradition, there's a lot of practice which is made in order to untie those knots. And sometimes I think very formal, and in this sense, I think the vipassana now being very mindful of everything appearing in the field of experience, bodily sensation, tension, emotions, and belief. This is a very, very skillful way in order to be aware of the belief that we were not aware, you know, holding. You know. Sometimes we, in a retreat, we hear people that have so hard time breathing. You know, it seems that the breathing for them is an effort, you know, and it will be absurd to teach them how to breathe, you know, because in a sense they are hindering the way they breathe. They're blocking some aspect of their chest, for example, blocking, and then breathing is difficult, so they need to make an effort. So if we were to teach how to breathe, it will be absurd, we'll make it even more complex, so that they not knowingly are preventing themselves to breathe, and then now they are forcefully trying to breathe. It's a conflict there, it's very tiring. So the best thing to do in Vipassana is let's be aware of how I'm holding the tension in the ribs, you know, how I'm holding there, and when I start to be mindful of that, I also see that there may be an emotion underneath. And slowly I bring harmony, and I don't block those things. And I may see there's a belief within that, you know. Belief that I'm holding and I was even not aware of it. So slowly there's a deeper disponibility that can happen in the practice. So I think there's a balance. It's not just, if it were about just don't do anything, then we all have tried. No problem, it's not difficult, it must be the most simple thing to do. But it's not the case for most of us. So in this sense, Vipassana is not a way to keep us busy so that we are not doing any other mischief, you know. It's a way also to touch all those areas that we are holding and even not being aware that is really conditioning us. So I think there is a very, very clear balance, and what we, for me, make a sense that why the right view is important, to know that when the disponibility is here, it is important then not to try to do anything anymore. So there's time when we feel there's this sensitivity which is there. It's very important at this time. Now I don't try to reach something, I want something deeper, something like that. Then I can just be open. But there are times where I need to work with the difficulty, emotional difficulties, physical difficulties. Working means not solving them, but bringing mindfulness to them. So I think it's very working together. No opposition, not... Okay, I think we'll... Yes. Okay, 9 o'clock, 8 o'clock we finish up the questions. So I thought we'll take 5 months, but 1 hour was enough. Okay.